This is Solve It for Kids.
Oh my goodness, so great to see you. Come right in. We've been saving a seat of honor just for you. Hi, my name is Jet Li. This is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, experts, and astronauts, and physicists, and all sorts of like wicked smart people as they solve problems using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson!
Hello, Jet! Wow, you seem really excited today.
It's because nothing but great things have been happening in my life. It is fantastic. We are so blessed to be living at this time in history. We get to talk to all these amazing scientist-type, STEM-type people, and it's fantastic.
Oh, just wait till you hear who we're talking with today. We're going to learn about the wonders of the universe.
The wonders of the universe. I'm always confused by the wonders of my sock drawer, but I think I can handle the wonders of the universe today. Hey, before we start, who are we going to say hi to?
Oh, we have to welcome our newest Solve It for Kids team member, Logan.
Hi, yeah!
Hey, Logan, we named our airport after you here in Boston. Welcome to the team. So good to see you. All right. So, what do we have to do? Oh, am I supposed to spin that wheel?
You are supposed to spin the wheel. Okay. Let's find out what we're going to talk about today.
How do you measure particles that are too small to be seen?
How do you measure? What did he say?
How do you measure a particle that can't be seen?
How do you measure particles that can't be seen? I have no idea.
Yeah, so we are excited to have Dr. Jean Van Buren today from Brookhaven National Laboratory to talk to us about little tiny particles that you can't even see, and yet we know a decent amount of information about them.
This is awesome. I can't wait. I think we should start things up right now.
Hi, my name's Gene Van Buren. I am a physicist working on a big nuclear physics experiment at a large national laboratory. And for a living, I try to understand the way that the universe has been put together.
Hey, Dr. Jean, I'm like really excited that you're on the show today. And I know Jennifer knows this stuff because she's like the dean of all things STEM and STEAM. But I'm really baffled. How do you go about figuring out how the universe was built?
The way that we try to understand the way that the universe is built is by trying to take the littlest, smallest building blocks of the universe and try to make them do something different. If we can try to get them to behave a little bit differently, we can understand what it is that drives how they behave. Imagine taking your Lego blocks that you'd stack together and build something. If you could heat up those building blocks and melt them into something to make them change, you'd learn a little bit more about those Lego blocks and how it is that they stick together. So what we try to do is we take the smallest building blocks that there are, and we get them super hot. And when they do change into something different. Now, I kind of like to think of this a little bit as imagine taking water. And if you heat it up, something really different happens to water. It turns into steam. It boils. And what's happening differently there? The molecules of water are actually behaving differently. In a solid ice cube of water, the molecules of water are so strongly stuck together that they don't even want to move. But if you get them warmer and water melts out of the ice, the water molecules still stick together, but they don't move completely freely. They still kind of want to stick together. They'll move around, but not completely freely. And when you get water even hotter and you turn it into steam by boiling, you can get those water molecules to actually become free of each other because they've got so much energy that they just won't stick together anymore. So this is telling us a bit about how water molecules behave. And if you understand the different conditions that make water turn from ice to liquid water and from liquid water into steam, you can understand about what the force is that holds those water molecules together and how they behave. So you could imagine, for example, that if water molecules were even more strongly attracted to each other, if they were even stickier, you'd have to get water hotter to get them to the point where they have enough energy to overcome that stickiness. So the temperature at which water boils or the temperature at which water freezes tells us a lot about the force that decides how those water molecules behave. So we'd like to do something similar with the very smallest building blocks of the universe, these little things that these days we call quarks and gluons. They also like to stick to each other, and they stick together and build up atoms and molecules and eventually the stuff that we have in our universe around us. And what we'd like to do to try to understand them better is something like making water boil. We want to get that stuff really, really hot, watch it do something different, and learn something from that. So that's the experiment that we try to do where I work. And we have been doing it now for quite a while. And it's a pretty complicated experiment to do because it's difficult to make things really, really hot. In our case, we have to get a lot hotter than just the temperature at which water boils. Water boils, if you've learned in school, perhaps at about 100 degrees Celsius. In our case, we need to go a lot hotter than that. We need to go hotter even than the temperature of the sun where nuclear fusion happening. We have to go not just to millions of degrees, but to millions of degrees to get these tiny little building blocks to do something like melting or turning.
So can I ask you a question? How small are we talking? Like, protons are made up of quarks and gluons, correct?
Yeah.
So we're talking, like, can you see these things that you guys are trying to look at?
No, you cannot. So you can imagine that that'd be really nice if we could.
Yeah.
These days, we've been able to sort of develop microscopes that can see down to about the atomic level. So you can see things that are about maybe 1/10 billionth of a meter.
Wow.
In our case, we need to go, just to see a proton, you have to go down to 1/1,000,000th of a billionth of a meter. But in our case, these are things that make up the proton, so you have to go even maybe a little bit further smaller to see what we're talking about.
So these things are all around us all the time, and they make up everything, like our chairs, our desks, our computers. And they're so, so microscopic that we just can't see them, right?
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Almost everything around us is made up of these tiny little things.
So Dr. Gene, you got to help me out here. So you're trying to measure something that's so small that you can't even see it, even with a microscope. Well, how do you even know that it's there?
Well, that's a really good question. So the answer comes in by the same process that we're doing now, watching how things behave. When you watch how they behave, that can tell you, hey, this is a solid object. Or it can tell you, hey, this isn't a solid object. It's actually made of smaller things that seem to be moving around. And that's exactly what's been happening over the centuries of trying to understand physics and the way that the universe works, is that you just watch something and see how it behaves. And you learn a little bit about how it's built by doing that. So we could, 100 years ago, we could start doing things with electrons, for example. People started to build tools with electrons that eventually led to televisions that we had 50 years ago. And the things that we've done with electrons are really amazing. The electricity and semiconductors, things like this, have formed a lot of what's in our modern world. But one of the things that we started doing with them in science was we started poking other things with electrons. When we did that, we could see, hey, there's some kind of internal stuff inside this thing that we're poking. It's not just a solid thing that the electrons are bouncing off of. It's actually going inside and bouncing off in specific directions, weird directions, because what's inside has some shape and structure to it.
So it's kind of like a ball, imagine, with little tiny balls inside of it, right?
Right.
Okay.
So if you're hitting electrons off of a marble or a ball, you'd see it bounce one way. But if the marble actually was made of three or more smaller marbles inside that, then the electrons would.
Very good. Yeah, all of the inside things might bounce in a different way.
Okay, so I'm starting to understand that. But one of the things I'm really baffled about is how in the world do you make something here on Earth hotter than the sun?
Oh, I like that question a lot. How do you make this stuff really hot? That is a good question. I wish that we had a oven or microwave that we could put up to that hot. You could pick 1 million degrees or 1 billion degrees or 1 trillion degrees. But we don't have that. So we had to come up with a different way to get things really hot. And we came up with a rather simple but kind of brute force idea. And that is that if we get two big chunks of this stuff, this little bitty stuff, but in large chunks, if we get that moving really, really fast and slam it into something, then all that energy of their initial motion can turn into energy of heat and create something. So we have to get it going very, very, very fast to make this happen. In our case, we get atoms, and actually the nucleus of an atom, up to about 99.995% the speed of light.
Wow.
Before it hits something else. And when it does that, that's bringing in a lot of energy, smashing together, and in a small space where those two things collide, a really, really high temperature that's truly... Well,
to have them collide, you'd have to have one going in one direction and one in the other, right?
You don't have to. You could actually have one sitting still and another
one.
But it turns out that when we do that, we just can't get it hot enough. So to get it even hotter, we do try to get two going fast and slam them head on into each other. And that gives us more energy and a higher temperature.
So that'd be like if you had, you're on a NASCAR race car kind of track, and you have one car going one way really, really fast, and the other car going the other way really, really fast, and then boom, they crash together, right?
Right.
Okay. And all the pieces fly off.
Right. Well, that's the next problem, is that when they collide, you'd really like to hold on to this stuff that you've just made super hot. And you can imagine a scientist who's got this neat stuff that's super hot. Nobody else has this stuff. You've got it in the laboratory. You'd like to put it in some kind of container so that you can look at it and poke it and probe it. But we don't have that luxury. We can't build a container that can hold this stuff that's trillions of degrees. So just like you said, when the collision happens, not long after, stuff just goes flying off. And unfortunately, we don't get to see this stuff while it is this hot trillions of degrees, because the stuff goes flying off in about a thousandth of a billionth of a billionth of a second.
My gosh.
That's how long it lives, is this super hot stuff. And
those of you that didn't see, Jed just kind of went, oh my gosh.
We can't build something that can record what's happening on that time scale. So what we have to do instead is look at this stuff that comes flying off, the debris, and we have to try to figure out, by looking at that debris, what it was that produced that debris, what happened in the collision such that the debris came off like this. I like to kind of make the example of, imagine if you had a firecracker and you lit it and you let it explode into hundreds or thousands of bits of debris. And from all those little bits, you want to understand the firecracker. How hot was the firecracker? What was the pressure and density inside of it? And if things did flow and move around inside the firecracker before it blew apart, how did it do so? How sticky was the stuff inside there before it blew apart? And that's a tough game to play by just looking at the debris that comes out, but that's really what we try to do.
But in order to do that, you'd have to go around and pick up every single little tiny piece, right, of the firecracker bits, figure out where it came from, and kind of reconstruct the firecracker?
That's a good point. Really nice to be able to look at every little bit of debris that comes out, but we're also not perfect at doing that. So we don't see everything that comes out. And that's one of the reasons why we can't just do one collision, look at the stuff that comes out, and reconstruct exactly what happened in that one collision. Instead, what we do is we take lots and lots of collisions, and in our case, maybe 10 billion collisions.
Oh, wow.
And from that, from the pieces of debris that we do see, we try to understand kind of what's happening on average. So there's some mathematics involved in that, trying to look at just a few things, but taking lots of pictures of a lot of those just few things, and then trying to understand what's happening in general.
You know, Jennifer, I think I'm starting to learn some things hanging out with you and all these really, really intelligent STEM people. And one thing I'm starting to realize is that all these, the engineers and the physicists and the scientists, a lot of these people that we talk to, one of the things they love to do is they love to smash things up.
Well, who does it? I mean, come on. When you were
I know.
Like, throw trucks against each other or whatever. But sometimes I think that's, as Gene said, it's the only way you can learn about things is to see how they interact. And I mean, if it's just sitting there doing nothing, then you don't see anything. But geez, if you smash things into each other, you start to get stuff. So just to be clear, the way that you study where these are is when you do all these collisions, you take pictures of them, right? In the ion collider.
Right. So the collision happens, and then we surround the place where the collision happens with what's essentially a big camera. In our case, it's a pretty fancy camera because it sees not just light that like a normal camera might see that we're used to, but it can see these other kinds of subatomic particles. And I do want to emphasize that a normal camera, you might not think of it as a subatomic particle detector. Photons, which make up light, are subatomic particles. So a camera that you have is a kind of subatomic particle detector. And in fact, you may not be thinking about it, but these two things that you have in your head to look around with, they're picking up light too. They're sensitive to light, and they're subatomic particle detectors. So in our case, ours is a little bit more fancy because it can see more than just light. It can see a whole bunch of other different kinds of bits of debris, other subatomic particles. And our camera can see not just a flat picture, but it can actually see fully which direction everything is going and how fast everything is going.
I bet you never thought about that, Jed. Your eyes are subatomic photon detectors, huh?
No. My eyes, you know, barely. Now I need glasses, but...
Dr. Gene, I have another question. How is it that you're taking these particles and you're making them go like so fast, like almost as fast as the speed of light, and you're heating things up to like billions of degrees, almost as hot as the sun or hotter than the sun. How is it that you're not hurt when these things smash together and go flying out? How is it that you're not burnt? I don't understand.
Yeah, that's a good question. This stuff is trillions of degrees. Why doesn't it just burn everything up? The reason that it doesn't is because temperature is actually an energy density. Now, that might be a little bit of a big word, but it's an energy per amount of stuff you have. So what we have to get a really high temperature is a lot of energy for these tiny, tiny little particles. And it's a few of these particles. It's maybe even 1,000 of these particles. But that's a really small number of particles compared to the number of particles that you have in your hand or in the walls. So once you take that energy, that's a lot of energy for just a few things, and you spread it out by having that stuff go into the materials of our camera, for example – it actually becomes a very tiny amount of energy for all that much stuff. And what that means, coming back to what temperature is that it's actually a very small increase in temperature for everything around it. So for a brief time, it's a super high temperature in a very, very small space with a rather small amount of stuff. And then as that spreads out, it's just almost something you'd never even be able to measure once it spreads out into the materials around it.
So I'm imagining, like, you know, when two cars hit, there's big noise, you know, bang, crash. This is kind of like a little poof. I mean, is that kind of right?
Yeah. You can imagine that if you were down there, you'd think, wow, this is immense. You know, this big, big thing is happening. But then you step back and you look at the larger world around and you see that this is really just a very small thing in the scale of the whole world. So like you said, if two cars collided, if you're right there next to them, whoa, disaster. But if you step back and look at the whole Earth, you did pretty much nothing to the whole Earth.
Yeah, that's true. So how does the camera work? Because you said these things are flying, you know, almost at the speed of light. Are you taking like thousands of pictures, you know, is your camera different? How that, not from a regular camera?
No, I like the comparison. We do try to take lots and lots of pictures, and we take pictures at a rate of about 2,000 pictures per second with the camera.
Wow, Jed again, listeners, just shook his head. He's like, wow, I'm blown away by this.
Yeah, it's a pretty expensive camera, I'll have to say that. But the camera, like I said before, doesn't get to see that tiny, tiny little collision where the stuff happens that's at a few trillion degrees. It gets to see these particles that come flying out, the debris. And so it's actually a pretty big camera. It doesn't have to be small. In our case, our camera is about the size of a three-story house. And
as wow.
The particles come out, they go into the place where we take the picture. And we snap a picture about every 2,000 times a second about.
Well, and so for our listeners, we'll have, make sure after this you go to our website, solveitpodcast.com, because we'll have pictures of the ion collider. I was lucky enough to visit it in person, and it is cool. I will just tell you that. It was really neat to see. So you have all these pictures. What is the purpose of this? You're trying to reconstruct. Does this tell you like how the universe was formed? What particles were there? Is that what you're trying to do with all of this?
Well, we start out by trying to understand the way that the universe is right now. And so when we can understand these tiny little building blocks, what all those little building blocks are and how they behave with each other, you can try to understand how they fit together, just like Lego pieces fitting together to make some kind of fun thing with Lego. You put these little blocks together and you build up things that we call protons and neutrons, and you put those together and they build up and form what we call atoms, and those build together to form molecules, and those build together to form the materials that are around us. So this starts with just trying to understand at the smallest level how we build up the things that are around us today. And it isn't just what's in your room. It's what's way out there in space. It's how you build stars. It's how you build planets and how those stars and planets behave over time. So because we can understand or begin better to understand how those things behave and how they interact over time, you can then try to project backwards a bit and try to understand how things started to get to where they are today. And so you can project all the way back to a very early time in the universe when things were even perhaps trillions of degrees, and they behaved then, because we might be seeing that right now in the laboratory when we get stuff to a few trillion degrees.
So this might have happened right after the Big Bang is kind of what you're looking for?
The Big Bang happened. It started at a super high temperature because, like we said before, temperature is how much energy you have in the amount of stuff you have. And at the beginning of the universe, everything was in this tiny, tiny little place, if the Big Bang theory is true. And all the energy that we have in the universe today was there at that time in that tiny little place. And that would have been a super high temperature. And so as it expands and the density begins to drop as stuff spreads out, the temperature also drops. And at some point it comes from some incredibly high temperature down through what's still a very high temperature of trillions of degrees.
Yeah.
Would be about the time that it would behave like what we're seeing here in the laboratory. And then it continues to cool as it expanded, and the expanding universe kept expanding and interacting in ways that we would learn about by watching what happens in our experiment until it eventually becomes the universe that we have today.
This has been a great show. Thanks so much, Gene, for being with us. I'm so excited to learn about all this and share this with kids because you know how excited I was when I came to visit your facility.
Hey, Dr. Gene, thanks so much for being on Solve It for Kids. Jennifer, that was amazing. Dr. Gene is like, I'm still, it's going to take me a while to get all this stuff straight in my mind.
Well, it is an exciting thing, particle physics. I mean, think about it. All these tiny, tiny particles are floating around you all over the time, and you don't even know they're there. And yet we can capture them with a camera. Not your camera, of course. The detector is gigantic and huge and all this kind of stuff. So, kids, if you want to see what the detector looks like, make sure you go to our website, solveforkids.com. There's pictures of the detectors on there. There's pictures of all of the other things, the accelerators, and there's even a video that shows you how these tiny particles collide and smash together.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, at solveforkids.com, that's where kids can go and become a team member like Logan, right?
Yes. So please go to solveforkids.com, click on the Become a Team Member, and it will take you to our Patreon page and ask your parents, and you can sign up.
Hey, Jennifer, this is awesome. I can't wait till next week.
Me either, because we're going to have a very, very special guest, and I will give you a hint. Yes, it is my daughter-in-law, who is a dentist.
Okay.
No, this will be a cool episode about dentistry.
Okay, well, I'll make sure I brush my teeth nice and good before we meet her. Until then, thanks for joining us here on
Solve It for Kids.